before God, to recognize God's superiority, to recognize that without God, we have nothing. To be poor in spirit is to recognize that without God, without His mercy, without His love, we have no hope for eternal life. It is arrogance to think that we can do anything as people to bridge that gap that we have created by sinning. From Adam on, it has been so. There is nothing that we can do as people to bridge that gap. We have to rely upon the Lord and His mercy to see us into heaven. And that's what this is talking about here, to be poor in spirit. And that's not always an easy thing. It's not easy for me to humble myself, period, but to think that I cannot rely on myself to get something accomplished. That goes against a lot of what America stands for as a country. You know, pull yourself up by your own bootstraps kind of mentality. And Jesus says here, blessed are the poor in spirit. That's the exact opposite of that mentality. To acknowledge that we are dependent upon something else for our own well-being. Verse 4, blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. This one's a little bit easier to understand, isn't it? What's Jesus talking about here? Mourning. What kind of mourning? Well, first let's start with what is mourning. There are many people in here who could probably answer that question. I'm not totally convinced that I have ever experienced true mourning in my lifetime. Mourning is not just sadness. It is something that goes so far beyond that, it's almost incomprehensible. When I think of mourning, I think of the family of Noah Chamberlain and the community that's grieving his loss, a loss that they can't understand, that I don't understand, that none of us can truly understand. Why did something like that have to happen? Why a sweet, innocent little boy was taken from his mother and father and from a community that loves him in such a fashion? We can't comprehend. I don't comprehend. When I think of mourning, I think of a situation we had back home where I live. I live in southwest Missouri, in a little bitty community called Greenfield. It's about 1,300 people, a little bit smaller than Henderson. Everybody knows everybody. And my brother, his best friend, his name was Mason Norman. And Mason was in that phase of life where everything's kind of looking up. You know, most of us can remember, I can remember vividly being 16 years old, getting all the college applications in the mail and people recruiting you and thinking about what you're going to do with your life and where you're going to go to school and the people you're going to meet and whether or not you're going to have a family, stuff like that. It's a fun time in life. He'd just gotten a new car. Mason just gotten a new car, learned how to drive. And he also played basketball. And because basketball coaches are cruel and unusual people, he had to be at the school at 5 a.m. in the morning, every morning, for basketball practice. So Mason gets in his car and makes the 5-mile commute to the school. But some things just don't go as planned. Whether he was sleep-deprived and fell asleep at the wheel, or if he just lost control of his vehicle, we will never know. But Mason slid off the road, hit an embankment, and was ejected from his vehicle. About 10 minutes after he crashed, another car came along and found the wreck, but they couldn't find Mason. And so a massive search started, and I remember my mother calling me, absolutely beside herself, sputtering, muttering incomprehensible, indistinguishable words. I could tell that she was distraught. And so they looked for Mason for the better part of 24 hours and never could find him. They trolled the lagoon where he had wrecked. They looked through the woods where he had wrecked. In about a 5-mile circle, they looked and they could not find him anywhere. Until later that night, his parents went home, and thinking that somehow he had survived this accident, he'd walked home, and was hiding in one of his favorite hiding spots out behind his house. And so his dad, just on a whim, went out there to look. And in the middle of his field, he found Mason, who had survived the crash, walked the 5 miles home, and in his addled state, taken the family gun off the wall, walked into the field, and taken his own life. I remember the phone call I got from my mother right after that happened, and it was a sadness that I could feel through the phone. I wanted to get in my car and I wanted to drive home and wrap my arms around my mother and comfort her. And it went on like that for days, an entire community devastated. Why do things like that happen? And why do they affect us so? But is it this kind of sadness that Jesus is talking about here? Maybe. That's certainly part of it. But another thing we don't often think about is what causes things like that to happen in the world. What we should really mourn is sin. Our own sin. The sin of the people around us. It is the result of sin that all of this comes about. Death, a direct result of sin. Adam and Eve. It goes back that far. So often we mourn the things that happen that we don't stop to mourn over the reason that they happen. To mourn is to recognize your own sin, the sin of the world, and the state that it has caused. Verse 5, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth." This would seem to go quite well with poor in spirit because the ideas are similar. It's to be humble. But it's a little bit different in that meek is talking more about self-control. Making sure that everything you do is thought through and that you don't act purely on emotion or instinct or anything like that. Self-control. And Jesus is a perfect example of being meek. Imagine the patience the man must have had with his apostles. Peter, oh my goodness. Sometimes I read about the stuff that Peter said or did, and it's like, how did he not slap him? This is just ridiculous. Peter, having seen all the things that Jesus had done in his ministry, the miracles he had worked, how he had walked on water in the midst of a storm, he had fed the crowds, the 5,000, all of these things. And when Jesus looks at him and says, "Before the rooster crows, you will deny me 3 times, Peter still has the audacity to say, "No, absolutely not. That's not going to happen. I've seen all that you've done, all that you've said, and how it has come about just as you said it would, but you can't be right in this." His patience extends to that of the people that followed him around. We don't often think about that, but Jesus had people following him around just about wherever he went. We see on TV all the time movie stars and athletes who are hounded by the paparazzi, who scrutinize every little thing that they do, just hoping that they're going to screw up, so they can plaster it on the front of a newspaper or post it on Facebook and Twitter and let the world know that somebody that we looked up to messed up. And that's how it was with Jesus. The Pharisees, the Sadducees, and all of these people that followed him around just waiting for him to slip up. And he had the patience to deal with all of them and know what he was to face in the end. Verse 6, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied." You ever been hungry? A lot of you are probably hungry right now. I'm hungry. I haven't eaten dinner. And I'm not necessarily looking forward to Gano, but it provides the food that my body desires so greatly. Have you ever been thirsty? I'm thirsty right now. I get dry mouth when I talk. But That's what Jesus uses as an example here, hunger and thirst. Let me tell you, I went to Alaska over the winter to attend the wedding of Jeff and Amber Smith, who are sitting down here close to the front. And because airlines, nothing went as planned whatsoever. I was supposed to leave Springfield at about 9 o'clock, get to Denver about lunchtime, have just enough time to eat a good lunch, and then hop on my plane to Alaska. Instead, I sat in Springfield for an extra 3 hours, left there at about noon, got to Chicago instead of Denver at about 4 o'clock, I don't really know how, and had just enough time to buy a banana and a sandwich that cost me $20. And that's what I had to eat for the day. And on my way to Alaska, I happened to sit next to the guy who owned all of the McDonald's in Anchorage. Go figure. And by the time we landed in Anchorage, I was seriously curious as to whether or not he would taste like a Big Mac. I was starving. I was starving. And over the summer, I try to run. I try to keep in shape. I try to run a couple of miles every day, and if you're anything like me, when you run, you do it slowly. And so those miles are extra long. And around about the time I'm getting around my last lap, all I can think about is my bottle of water waiting for me in my car. The only reason I'm still running is so I can finish that and get to my water. That's all I think about, because I'm thirsty. Whenever I get done with classes, I look forward to going back to my dorm room, laying down in my bed, and playing Madden until my eyes bleed. I look forward to it. I desire to do that. And that's what Jesus is relaying here. We should have a desire for righteousness. How many of you can say that you truly have that desire? I can't. I find myself coming up short in this regard all the time. Spending time reading my Bible. Spending time reaching out to those who don't know Christ. Spending time doing the things I know I ought to be doing, but instead it's a chore. Jesus says we should hunger and thirst for it. It should be all we think about. And I wonder sometimes how well we do in that regard. Verse 7, blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. To be merciful, that's an easy idea to think about. Jesus, I think of Jesus and God when I think of mercy. I think of certain teachers that I have had throughout the course of my high school and collegiate career that maybe gave me a grade that I didn't exactly earn because they're merciful. And we love people like that, don't we? I love a merciful person, somebody who's going to cut me some slack even when I don't always deserve it. But it's not easy to be that person, is it? Especially when you're dealing with people who might have wronged you, people who have angered you, sometimes gone out of their way to do that. It's not easy to look somebody who has wronged you in the face and say, I forgive you, and then treat them in such a way as they don't deserve to be treated, in your mind at least. But that's what Jesus calls us to do, to be pure in heart. Well, what does that mean? We just sang a song, Purer in Heart. Purer in heart, O God, help me to be. May I devote my life wholly to Thee. It's the first two lines of that song, and it's beautiful because it perfectly sums up what it means to be pure in heart, to completely and totally devote your life to God, to not only refuse to sin, but to flee the very presence of sin. That's hard. That's not easy. I struggle with that. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Peacemaker. What does that mean? I'll tell you what it doesn't mean. It's not talking about pacifism, and it's also not talking about a cult peacemaker. It's not talking about having massive wars in the name of peace. But neither is it talking about sitting by and letting people bully you. There's a line that has to be walked there. You should be actively seeking to end conflict. That's what this means. Where there is conflict, peace needs to be made. And as Christians, we are called to help that process along. Up to this point, we've covered poor in spirit, those who mourn, the meek, those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, the merciful, the pure in heart, and the peacemakers. And these seven are a little bit different from the last two here. And I hope you can see the process. The poor in spirit, it starts by acknowledging God's superiority. That's where it all starts. Acknowledging that He is a higher power and that you need Him. From there, you should mourn the sins of your past, the sins that you continue to commit, because we're human and we all sin. After you mourn, seek to master yourself, become meek, self-control. Once you have self-control, you should actively pursue that which is right. Hunger and thirst for righteousness. And in your pursuit of righteousness, you will become merciful, pure in heart, and become a peacemaker. In these traits, you become something different. Something that other people will look at and see and say, that's different. That's not what I'm used to. That goes against the grain. Something's off here. And that's a good thing. But reading on with these last two, verse 10, blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. So all of this, the end result, is persecution. You become different, you become persecuted. That doesn't sound like a good deal to me. I understand that all of these have an eschatological impact, that is, they have an impact on your eternal life, on the end. But is that worth living a life of persecution? It just seems negative to me. And that's where this word blessed comes into play. We haven't talked about what this means. Some of your translations that you have in front of you might even have the word happy. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Happy are the poor in spirit. That doesn't make any sense. How am I supposed to be happy while I'm being persecuted? As a matter of fact, in verse 12, he tells us, rejoice and be glad. If you take these things, this path, as it were, you become blessed. And I'm not sure there is a single English word that can accurately relay what this is talking about. But I'll do my best here. To be blessed is to have a feeling of contentment, of happiness, of joy that transcends all other things. It is a happiness, it is a joy, it is a mirth that you experience because you know that you are right in the sight of God, that you are on the path that you ought to be on. And nobody can take that away from you. No matter the persecution, no matter what they say or what they do, you know where your reward lies. And you know that the sufferings of this life are only temporary. Breaks from school, for me, are good in that I get some time to recharge. I get a little time off to rest myself and get ready for the next academic semester. But if you're like me, breaks can also lead to more negative things. Slip into old habits that you ought not to have. Hang out with people that you ought not to hang out with. Do things that you ought not to do. And coming back here and surrounding yourself with good Christian people is a blessing. If you haven't made a New Year's New Year's resolution that Ray talked about last Wednesday, now is a good time. It's late into January, so you're behind, but I think if we all resolved to pattern our lives after these Beatitudes, after the words of Jesus here in Matthew 5, we would all be happier and live better lives for it. We would be better equipped to spread the word, to shine our light. When I got off of the airplane in Anchorage, I looked to the east, and the very first thing that I noticed were mountains. And the entire time I was there, I could not get over the beauty and the grandeur of the mountains. And one night, the groomsmen and Jeff were staying in a hotel, and we were up on like the 5th, 6th level, so you could see almost in the distance. It looked like you were looking right at the peaks of those mountains. And we got up before sunrise. I don't know why. But we got up before sunrise one day, and I looked out there just in time to see the sun start peeking over the mountains. And it was gorgeous. And I stood in amazement of the beauty of God's creation. And just as I stood in the amazement of the beauty of the mountains, the people that heard Jesus deliver this Sermon on the Mount stood in amazement for various reasons. But I think it was because of the beauty of what he had to say. This is encouraging. This has ramifications far beyond physical life. To know that you are saved, to be blessed, that's what Jesus is talking about here. Some time ago, I was very disappointed in myself with some decisions that I made, with some things that I had done. I was not proud of it. I was disgusted with myself. And so one Wednesday night, much like this, I made the decision to come forward and to confess and to lean upon the support of this congregation for help. Brothers and sisters, it was the best decision I have ever made. We are a family, and we are here to support one another. If you have that same feeling, if you are not content with the life you have been leading, if you have done things you are not proud of, you need only muster the courage to come forward. This is the opportunity to confess and to lean on the love and support of this great congregation. Maybe you've not been baptized. Maybe you have never heard of the love of Jesus until tonight, and you want to make that change. You want to become a Christian. You want to ensure your salvation. If that be the case, we ask that you would come as together we stand and sing.